Soon we were sitting in a chop suey joint, seated side by side in a little booth, behaving exactly like a pair of rabbits in rut. On the dance floor we hardly moved. We were wedged in tightly, and we stayed that way, letting them jog and jostle us about as they might. I could have taken her home to my place, as I was alone at the time, but no. I had a notion to bring her back to her own home, stand her up in the vestibule, and give her a fuck right under Maxie's nose. Which I did. In the midst of it, I thought again of the mannequin in the show window, and of the way he had laughed that afternoon when I let drop the word Quim. I was on the point of laughing aloud when suddenly I felt she was coming, one of those long, drawn-out orgasms such as you get now and then in a Jewish cunt. I had my hands under her buttocks, the tips of my fingers just inside her cunt, in the lining, as it were. As she began to shudder, I lifted her from the ground and raised her gently up and down on the end of my cock. I thought she would go off her nut completely, the way she began to carry on. She must have had four or five orgasms like that, in the air, before I put her feet down on the ground. I took it out without spilling a drop, and made her lie down in the vestibule. Her hat had rolled off into a corner, and her handbag had spilled open, and a few coins had tumbled out. I note this because just before I gave it to her good and proper, I made a mental note to pocket a few coins for my carfare home. Anyway, it was only a few hours since I had said to Maxie in the bathhouse that I would like to take a look at his sister's Quim, and here it was now, smack up against me, sopping wet and throwing out one squirt after another. If she had been fucked before, she had never been fucked properly. That's a cinch. And I myself was never in such a fine, cool, collected, scientific frame of mind as now, lying on the floor of the vestibule, right under Maxie's nose, pumping it into the private, sacred, and extraordinary Quim of his sister Rita. I could have held it in indefinitely. It was incredible how detached I was, and yet thoroughly aware of every quiver and jolt she made. But somebody had to pay for making me walk around in the rain grubbing a dime. Somebody had to pay for the ecstasy produced by the germination of all those unwritten books inside me. Somebody had to verify the authenticity of this private, concealed cunt which had been plaguing me for weeks and months. Who better qualified than I? I thought so hard and fast between orgasms that my cock must have grown another inch or two. Finally, I decided to make an end of it by turning her over and back-scuttling her. She balked a bit at first, but when she felt the thing slipping out of her, she nearly went crazy. Oh yes, do it," she gibbered. And with that, I really got excited. I had hardly slipped it into her when I felt it coming, one of those long, agonizing spurts from the tip of the spinal column. I shoved it in so deep that I felt as if something had given way. We fell over, exhausted, the both of us, and panted like dogs. At the same time, however, I had the presence of mind to feel around for a few coins. Not that it was necessary, because she had already loaned me a few dollars, but to make up for the carfare which I was lacking in Far Rockaway. Even then, by Jesus, it wasn't finished. Soon I felt her groping about, first with her hands, then with her mouth. I had still a sort of semi-hard-on. She got it into her mouth and she began to caress it with her tongue. I saw stars. The next thing I knew, her feet were around my neck and my tongue up her twat. And then I had to get over her again and shove it in up to the hilt. She squirmed around like an eel, so help me God. And then she began to come again. Long, drawn-out, agonizing orgasms, with a whimpering and gibbering that was hallucinating. Finally, I had to pull it out and tell her to stop. What a quim! And I had only asked to take a look at it. Maxie, with his talk of Odessa, revived something which I had lost as a child. Though I had never a very clear picture of Odessa, the aura of it was like the little neighborhood in Brooklyn which meant so much to me, and from which I had been torn away too soon. I get a very definite feeling of it every time I see an Italian painting without perspective. If it is a picture of a funeral procession, for example, it is exactly the sort of experience which I knew as a child, one of intense immediacy. If it is a picture of the open street, the women sitting in the windows are sitting on the street, and not above it and away from it. Everything that happens is known immediately by everybody, just as among primitive people. Murder is in the air. Chance rules. Just as in the Italian primitives, this perspective is lacking, so in the little old neighborhood from which I was uprooted as a child, there were these parallel vertical planes on which everything took place and through which, from layer to layer, everything was communicated as if by osmosis. The frontiers were sharp, clearly defined, but they were not impassable. I lived then, as a boy, close to the boundary between the north and the south side. I was just a little bit over on the north side, just a few steps from a broad thoroughfare called North Second Street, which was for me the real boundary line between the north and the south side. The actual boundary was Grand Street, which led to Broadway Ferry, but this street meant nothing to me, except that it was already beginning to be filled with Jews. No, North Second Street was the mystery street, the frontier between two worlds. I was living, therefore, between two boundaries, the one real, the other imaginary, as I have lived all my life. There was a little street, just a block long, which lay between Grand Street and North Second Street, called Fillmore Place. This little street was obliquely opposite the house my grandfather owned and in which we lived. It was the most enchanting street I have ever seen in all my life. It was the ideal street for a boy, a lover, a maniac, a drunkard, a crook, a lecher, a thug, an astronomer, a musician, a poet, a tailor, a shoemaker, a politician. In fact, this was just the sort of street it was, containing just such representatives of the human race, each one a world unto himself, and all living together harmoniously and inharmoniously, but together, a solid corporation, a close-knit human spore which could not disintegrate unless the street itself disintegrated. So it seemed, at least, until the Williamsburg Bridge was opened, whereupon there followed the invasion of the Jews from Delancey Street, New York. This brought about the disintegration of our little world, of the little street called Fillmore Place, which, like the name itself, was a street of value, of dignity, of light, of surprises. The Jews came, as I say, and like moths they began to eat into the fabric of our lives until there was nothing left but this moth-like presence which they brought with them everywhere. Soon the street began to smell bad, soon the real people moved away. Soon the houses began to deteriorate, and even the stoops fell away, like the paint. Soon the street looked like a dirty mouth, with all the prominent teeth missing, with ugly charred stumps gaping here and there, the lips rotting, the palate gone. Soon the garbage was knee-deep in the gutter, and the fire escapes filled with bloated bedding, with cockroaches, with dried blood. Soon the kosher sign appeared on the shop windows, and there was poultry everywhere, and lox, and sour pickles, and enormous loaves of bread. Soon there were baby carriages in every areaway, and on the stoops, and in the little yards, and before the shop fronts. And with the change, the English language also disappeared. One heard nothing but Yiddish, nothing but this sputtering, choking, hissing tongue in which God and rotten vegetables sound alike and mean alike. We were among the first families to move away, following the invasion. Two or three times a year I came back to the old neighborhood for a birthday or for Christmas or Thanksgiving. With each visit, I marked the loss of something I had loved and cherished. It was like a bad dream. It got worse and worse. The house in which my relatives still lived was like an old fortress going to ruin. They were stranded in one of the wings of the fortress, maintaining a forlorn, island life, beginning themselves to look sheepish, hunted, degraded. They even began to make distinctions between their Jewish neighbors, finding some of them quite human, quite decent, clean, kind, sympathetic, charitable, etc., etc. To me it was heartrending. I could have taken a machine gun and mowed the whole neighborhood down, Jew and Gentile together. It was about the time of the invasion that the authorities decided to change the name of North Second Street to Metropolitan Avenue. This highway, which to the Gentiles had been the road to the cemeteries, now became what is called an artery of traffic, a link between two ghettos. On the New York side, the riverfront was rapidly being transformed owing to the erection of the skyscrapers. On our side, the Brooklyn side, the warehouses were piling up, and the approaches to the various new bridges created plazas, comfort stations, pool rooms, stationery shops, ice cream parlors, restaurants, clothing stores, hock shops, etc. In short, everything was becoming metropolitan, in the odious sense of the word. As long as we lived in the old neighborhood, we never referred to Metropolitan Avenue. It was always North 2nd Street, despite the official change of name. Perhaps it was 8 or 10 years later, when I stood one winter's day at the corner of the street facing the river and noticed for the first time the great tower of the Metropolitan Life Insurance Building, that I realized that North 2nd Street was no more. The imaginary boundary of my world had changed. My glance traveled now far beyond the cemeteries, far beyond the rivers, far beyond the city of New York or the state of New York, beyond the whole United States indeed. At Point Loma, California, I had looked out upon the broad Pacific, and I had felt something there which kept my face permanently screwed in another direction. I came back to the old neighborhood, I remember, one night with my old friend Stanley, who had just come out of the army, and we walked the streets sadly and wistfully. A European can scarcely know what this feeling is like. Even when a town becomes modernized in Europe, there are still vestiges of the old. In America, though there are vestiges, they are effaced, wiped out of the consciousness, trampled upon, obliterated, nullified by the new. The new is, from day to day, a moth which eats into the fabric of life, leaving nothing finally but a great hole. Stanley and I, we were walking through this terrifying hole. Even a war does not bring this kind of desolation and destruction. Through war, a town may be reduced to ashes, and the entire population wiped out, but what springs up again resembles the old. Death is fecundating, for the soil as well as for the spirit. In America, the destruction is complete, annihilating. There is no rebirth, only a cancerous growth, layer upon layer of new, poisonous tissue, each one uglier than the previous one. We were walking through this enormous hole, as I say, and it was a winter's night, clear, frosty, sparkling, and as we came through the south side toward the boundary line, we saluted all the old relics or the spots where things had once stood and where there had been once something of ourselves. And as we approached North 2nd Street, between Fillmore Place and North 2nd Street, a distance of only a few yards, and yet such a rich, full area of the globe, before Mrs. O'Melio's shanty, I stopped and looked up at the house where I had known what it was to really have a being. Everything had shrunk now to diminutive proportions, including the world which lay beyond the boundary line, the world which had been so mysterious to me and so terrifyingly grand, so delimited. Standing there in a trance, I suddenly recalled a dream which I have had over and over, which I still dream now and then, and which I hope to dream as long as I live. It was the dream of passing the boundary line. As in all dreams, the remarkable thing is the vividness of the reality, the fact that one is in reality and not dreaming. Across the line I am unknown and absolutely alone. Even the language has changed. In fact, I am always regarded as a stranger, a foreigner. I have unlimited time on my hands, and I am absolutely content in sauntering through the streets. There is only one street, I must say, the continuation of the street on which I lived. I come finally to an iron bridge over the railroad yards. It is always nightfall when I reach the bridge, though it is only a short distance from the boundary line. Here I look down upon the webbed tracks, the freight stations, the tenders, the storage sheds, and as I gaze down upon this cluster of strange moving substances, a process of metamorphosis takes place, just as in a dream. With the transformation and deformation, I become aware that this is the old dream which I have dreamed so often. I have a wild fear that I shall wake up, and indeed I know that I will wake up shortly, just at the moment when in the midst of a great open space I am about to walk into the house which contains something of the greatest importance for me. Just as I go toward this house, the lot on which I am standing begins to grow vague at the edges, to dissolve, to vanish. Space rolls in on me like a carpet and swallows me up, and with it, of course, the house which I never succeed in entering. There is absolutely no transition from this, the most pleasurable dream I know, to the heart of a book called Creative Evolution. In this book by Henri Bergson, which I came to as naturally as to the dream of the land beyond the boundary, I am again quite alone, again a foreigner, again a man of indeterminate age, standing on an iron bridge, observing a peculiar metamorphosis without and within. If this book had not fallen into my hands at the precise moment it did, perhaps I would have gone mad. It came at a moment when another huge world was crumbling on my hands. If I had never understood a thing which was written in this book, if I have preserved only the memory of one word, creative, it is quite sufficient. This word was my talisman. With it I was able to defy the whole world, and especially my friends. There are times when one must break with one's friends in order to understand the meaning of friendship. It may seem strange to say so, but the discovery of this book was equivalent to the discovery of a weapon, an implement, wherewith I might lop off all the friends who surrounded me and who no longer meant anything to me. This book became my friend, because it taught me that I had no need of friends. It gave me the courage to stand alone, and it enabled me to appreciate loneliness. I have never understood the book. At times I thought I was on the point of understanding, but I never really did understand. It was more important for me not to understand. With this book in my hands, reading aloud to my friends, questioning them, explaining to them, I was made clearly to understand that I had no friends, that I was alone in the world. Because in not understanding the meaning of the words, neither I nor my friends, one thing became very clear, and that was that there were ways of not understanding, and that the difference between the non-understanding of one individual and the non-understanding of another created a world of terra firma even more solid than differences of understanding. Everything which once I thought I had understood crumbled, and I was left with a clean slate. My friends, on the other hand, entrenched themselves more solidly in the little ditch of understanding which they had dug for themselves. They died comfortably in their little bed of understanding to become useful citizens of the world. I pitied them, and in short order I deserted them, one by one, without the slightest regret. What was there, then, in this book which could mean so much to me and yet remain obscure? I come back to the word creative. I am sure that the whole mystery lies in the realization of the meaning of this word. When I think of the book now, and the way I approached it, I think of a man going through the rites of initiation. The disorientation and reorientation which comes with the initiation into any mystery is the most wonderful experience which it is possible to have. Everything which the brain has labored for a lifetime to assimilate, categorize, and synthesize has to be taken apart and reordered. Moving day for the soul. And, of course, it's not for a day, but for weeks and months that this goes on. You meet a friend on the street by chance, one whom you haven't seen for several weeks, and he has become an absolute stranger to you. You give him a few signals from your new perch, and if he doesn't cotton, you pass him up. For good. It's exactly like mopping up a battlefield. All those who are hopelessly disabled and agonizing, you dispatch with one swift blow of your club. You move on, to new fields of battle, to new triumphs or defeats. But you move. And as you move, the world moves with you, with terrifying exactitude. You seek out new fields of operation, new specimens of the human race whom you patiently instruct and equip with the new symbols. You choose sometimes those whom you would never have looked at before. You try everybody and everything within range, provided they are ignorant of the revelation. It was in this fashion that I found myself sitting in the busheling room of my father's establishment, reading aloud to the Jews who were working there, reading to them from this new Bible in the way that Paul must have talked to the disciples. With the added disadvantage, to be sure, that these poor Jew bastards could not read the English language. Primarily, I was directing myself toward Bunchuk, the cutter, who had a rabbinical mind. Opening the book, I would pick a passage at random and read it to them in a transposed English almost as primitive as pidgin English. Then I would attempt to explain, choosing for example and analogy the things they were familiar with. It was amazing to me how well they understood, how much better they understood, let me say, than a college professor or a literary man or any educated man. Naturally, what they understood had nothing to do finally with Bergson's book, as a book, but was not that the purpose of such a book as this? My understanding of the meaning of a book is that the book itself disappears from sight, that it is chewed alive, digested, and incorporated into the system as flesh and blood, which in turn creates new spirit and reshapes the world. It was a great communion feast which we shared in the reading of this book, and the outstanding feature of it was the chapter on disorder, which, having penetrated me through and through, has endowed me with such a marvelous sense of order that if a comet suddenly struck the earth and jarred everything out of place, stood everything upside down, turned everything inside out, I could orient myself to the new order in the twinkling of an eye. I have no fear or illusions about disorder any more than I have of death. The labyrinth is my happy hunting ground, and the deeper I burrow into the maze, the more oriented I become. With creative evolution under my arm, I board the elevated line at the Brooklyn Bridge after work, and I commence the journey homeward toward the cemetery. Sometimes I get on at Delancey Street, the very heart of the ghetto, after a long walk through the crowded streets. I enter the elevated line below the ground, like a worm being pushed through the intestines. I know each time I take my place in the crowd which mills about the platform that I am the most unique individual down there. I look upon everything which is happening about me like a spectator from another planet. My language, my world, is under my arm. I am the guardian of a great secret. If I were to open my mouth and talk, I would tie up traffic. What I have to say, and what I am holding in every night of my life on this journey to and from the office, is absolute dynamite. I am not ready yet to throw my stick of dynamite. I nibble at it, meditatively, ruminatively, cogently. 5 more years, 10 more years perhaps, and I will wipe these people out utterly. If the train in making a curve gives a violent lurch, I say to myself, fine, jump the track, annihilate them. I never think of myself as being endangered should the train jump the track. We're wedged in like sardines, and all the hot flesh pressed against me diverts my thoughts. I become conscious of a pair of legs wrapped around mine. I look down at the girl sitting in front of me. I look her right in the eye, and I press my knees still further into her crotch. She grows uneasy, fidgets about in her seat, and finally she turns to the girl next to her and complains that I am molesting her. The people about look at me hostily. I look out of the window blandly and pretend I have heard nothing. Even if I wish to, I can't remove my legs. Little by little, though, the girl, by a violent pushing and squiggling, manages to unwrap her legs from mine. I find myself almost in the same situation with the girl next to her, the one she was addressing her complaints to. Almost at once I feel a sympathetic touch, and then, to my surprise, I hear her tell the other girl that one can't help these things, that it is really not the man's fault, but the fault of the company, for packing us in like sheep. And again I feel the quiver of her legs against mine, a warm, human pressure, like squeezing one's hand. With my one free hand I manage to open my book. My object is twofold. First, I want her to see the kind of book I read. Second, I want to be able to carry on the leg language without attracting attention. It works beautifully. By the time the train empties a bit, I am able to take a seat beside her and converse with her, about the book, naturally. She's a voluptuous Jewess, with enormous liquid eyes and the frankness which comes from sensuality. When it comes time to get off, we walk arm in arm through the streets toward her home. I am almost on the confines of the old neighborhood. Everything is familiar to me, and yet repulsively strange. I have not walked these streets for years, and now I am walking with a Jew girl from the ghetto, a beautiful girl with a strong Jewish accent. I look incongruous walking beside her. I can sense that people are staring at us behind our backs. I am the intruder, the goy who has come down into the neighborhood to pick off a nice ripe cunt. She, on the other hand, seems to be proud of her conquest. She's showing me off to her friends. This is what I picked up in the train, an educated goy, a refined goy. I can almost hear her think it. Walking slowly, I'm getting the lay of the land, all the practical details which will decide whether I call for her after dinner or not. There's no thought of asking her to dinner. It's a question of what time, and where to meet, and how will we go about it, because, as she lets drop just before we reach the door, she's got a husband who's a traveling salesman, and she's got to be careful. I agree to come back and to meet her at the corner in front of the candy store at a certain hour. If I want to bring a friend along, she'll bring her girlfriend. No, I decide to see her alone. It's agreed. She squeezes my hand and darts off into a dirty hallway. I beat it quickly back to the elevated station and hasten home to gulp down the meal. It's a summer's night, and everything flung wide open. Riding back to meet her, the whole past rushes up kaleidoscopically. This time I've left the book at home. It's Kant I'm out for now, and no thought of the book is in my head. I am back again, this side of the boundary line, each station whizzing past, making my world grow more diminutive. I am almost a child by the time I reach the destination. I am a child who is horrified by the metamorphosis which has taken place. What has happened to me, a man of the 14th Ward, to be jumping off at this station in search of a Jewish cunt? Supposing I do give her a fuck, what then? What have I got to say to a girl like that? What's a fuck when what I want is love? Yes, suddenly it comes over me like a tornado. Una, the girl I loved, the girl who lived here in this neighborhood, Una with big blue eyes and flaxen hair, Una who made me tremble just to look at her, Una whom I was afraid to kiss or even to touch her hand. Where is Una? Yes, suddenly that's the burning question. Where is Una? In 2 seconds I am completely unnerved, completely lost, desolate, in the most horrible anguish and despair. How did I ever let her go? Why? What happened? When did it happen? I thought of her like a maniac, night and day, year in and year out, and then, without even noticing it, she drops out of my mind, like that, like a penny falling through a hole in your pocket. Incredible, monstrous, mad. Why, all I had to do was ask her to marry me, ask her hand, that's all. If I had done that, she would have said yes immediately. She loved me. She loved me desperately. Why, yes, I remember now. I remember how she looked at me the last time we met. I was saying goodbye because I was leaving that night for California, leaving everybody to begin a new life. And I never had any intention of leading a new life. I intended to ask her to marry me, but the story I had framed like a dope came out of my lips so naturally that I believed it myself. And so I said goodbye, and I walked off, and she stood there looking after me, and I felt her eyes pierce me through and through. I heard her howling inside. But like an automaton, I kept on walking, and finally I turned the corner, and that was the end of it. Goodbye. Like that. Like in a coma. And I meant to say, come to me. Come to me because I can't live any more without you. I am so weak, so rocky, that I can scarcely climb down the L steps. Now I know what's happened. I've crossed the boundary line. This Bible that I've been carrying around with me is to instruct me, initiate me into a new way of life. The world I knew is no more. It is dead, finished, cleaned up. And everything that I was is cleaned up with it. I am a carcass getting an injection of new life. I am bright and glittery, rabid with new discoveries, but in the center it is still leaden, still slag. I begin to weep, right there on the L stairs. I sob aloud, like a child. Now it dawns on me with full clarity. You are alone in the world. You are alone. 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 It is bitter to be alone. Bitter. 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 There is no end to it. It is unfathomable, and it is the lot of every man on earth, but especially mine. Especially mine. Again, the metamorphosis. Again, everything totters and careens. I am in the dream again, the painful, delirious, pleasurable, maddening dream of beyond the boundary. I am standing in the center of the vacant lot, but my home I do not see. I have no home. The dream was a mirage. There never was a house in the midst of the vacant lot. That's why I was never able to enter it. My home is not in this world, nor in the next. I am a man without a home, without a friend, without a wife. I am a monster who belongs to a reality which does not exist yet. Ah, but it does exist. It will exist. I am sure of it. I walk now rapidly, head down, muttering to myself. I have forgotten about my rendezvous so completely that I never even noticed whether I walked past her or not. Probably I did. Probably I looked right at her and didn't recognize her. Probably she didn't recognize me either. I am mad, mad with pain, mad with anguish. I am desperate, but I am not lost. No, there is a reality to which I belong. It's far away, very far away. I may walk from now till doomsday with head down and never find it, but it is there, I am sure of it. I look at people murderously. If I could throw a bomb and blow the whole neighborhood to smithereens, I would do it. I would be happy seeing them fly in the air, mangled, shrieking, torn apart, annihilated. I want to annihilate the whole earth. I am not a part of it. It's mad from start to finish, the whole shooting match. It's a huge piece of stale cheese with maggots festering inside it. Fuck it. Blow it to hell. Kill. Kill, kill, kill them all, Jews and Gentiles, young and old, good and bad. I grow light. Light as a feather, and my pace becomes more steady, more calm, more even. What a beautiful night it is. The stars shining so brightly, so serenely, so remotely. Not mocking me, precisely, but reminding me of the futility of it all. Who are you, young man, to be talking of the earth, of blowing things to smithereens? Young man, we have been hanging here for millions and billions of years. We have seen it all, everything. And still we shine peacefully every night. We light the way. We still the heart. Look around you, young man. See how still and beautiful everything is? Do you see even the garbage lying in the gutter looks beautiful in this light? Pick up the little cabbage leaf. Hold it gently in your hand. I bend down and pick up the cabbage leaf lying in the gutter. It looks absolutely new to me, a whole universe in itself. I break a little piece off and examine that. Still a universe, still unspeakably beautiful and mysterious. I am almost ashamed to throw it back in the gutter. I bend down and deposit it gently with the other refuse. I become very thoughtful, very, very calm. I love everybody in the world. I know that somewhere at this very moment there is a woman waiting for me, and if only I proceed very calmly, very gently, very slowly, I will come to her. She will be standing on a corner, perhaps, and when I come in sight she will recognize me, immediately. I believe this, so help me God. I believe that everything is just and ordained. My home? Why, it is the world, the whole world. I am at home everywhere, only I did not know it before, but I know now. There is no boundary line anymore. There never was a boundary line. It was I who made it. I walk slowly and blissfully through the streets, the beloved streets, where everybody walks and everybody suffers without showing it. When I stand and lean against a lamppost to light my cigarette, even the lamppost feels friendly. It is not a thing of iron. It is a creation of the human mind, shaped a certain way, twisted and formed by human hands, blown on with human breath, placed by human hands and feet. I turn round and rub my hand over the iron surface. It almost seems to speak to me. It is a human lamppost. It belongs, like the cabbage leaf, like the torn socks, like the mattress, like the kitchen sink. Everything stands in a certain way, in a certain place, as our mind stands in relation to God. The world, in its visible, tangible substance, is a map of our love. Not God, but life is love. Love, love, love. And in the midmost midst of it walks this young man, myself, who is none other than Gottlieb Leberecht Müller. Gottlieb Leberecht Müller. This is the name of a man who lost his identity. Nobody could tell him who he was, where he came from, or what had happened to him. In the movies, where I first made the acquaintance of this individual, it was assumed that he had met with an accident in the war. But when I recognized myself on the screen, knowing that I had never been to the war, I realized that the author had invented this little piece of fiction in order not to expose me. Often I forget which is the real me. Often in my dreams I take the draft of forgetfulness, as it is called, and I wander forlorn and desperate, seeking the body and the name which is mine. And sometimes, between the dream and reality, there is only the thinnest line. Sometimes, while a person is talking to me, I step out of my shoes, and like a plant drifting with the current, I begin the voyage of my rootless self. In this condition, I am quite capable of fulfilling the ordinary demands of life, of finding a wife, of becoming a father, of supporting the household, of entertaining friends, of reading books, of paying taxes, of performing military service, and so on and so forth. In this condition I am capable, if needs be, of killing in cold blood for the sake of my family, or to protect my country, or whatever it may be. I am the ordinary routine citizen who answers to a name and who is given a number in his passport. I am thoroughly irresponsible for my fate. Then one day, without the slightest warning, I wake up, and looking about me, I understand absolutely nothing of what is going on about me. Neither my own behavior, nor that of my neighbors, nor do I understand why the governments are at war or at peace, whichever the case may be. At such moments I am born anew, born and baptized by my right name, Gottlieb Leberecht Müller. Everything I do in my right name is looked upon as crazy. People make furtive signs behind my back, sometimes to my face even. I am forced to break with friends and family and loved ones. I am obliged to break camp. And so, just as naturally as in dream, I find myself once again drifting with the current, usually walking along a highway, my face set toward the sinking sun. Now all my faculties become alert. I am the most suave, silky, cunning animal. And I am at the same time what might be called a holy man. I know how to fend for myself. I know how to avoid work, how to avoid entangling relationships, how to avoid pity, sympathy, bravery, and all the other pitfalls. I stay in place or with a person just long enough to obtain what I need, and then I'm off again. I have no goal. The aimless wandering is sufficient unto itself. I am free as a bird, sure as an equilibrist. Manna falls from the sky. I have only to hold out my hands and receive. And everywhere I leave the most pleasant feeling behind me, as though, in accepting the gifts that are showered upon me, I am doing a real favor to others. Even my dirty linen is taken care of by loving hands, because everybody loves a right living man. Gottlieb. What a beautiful name it is. Gottlieb. I say it to myself over and over. Gottlieb Leberecht Müller. In this condition I have always fallen in with thieves and rogues and murderers, and how kind and gentle they have been with me, as though they were my brothers. And are they not, indeed? Have I not been guilty of every crime and suffered for it? And is it not just because of my crimes that I am united so closely to my fellow man? Always when I see a light of recognition in the other person's eyes, I am aware of this secret bond. It is only the just whose eyes never light up. It is the just who have never known the secret of human fellowship. It is the just who are committing the crimes against man, the just who are the real monsters. It is the just who demand our fingerprints, who prove to us that we have died even when we stand before them in the flesh. It is the just who impose upon us arbitrary names, false names, who put false dates in the register and bury us alive. I prefer the thieves, the rogues, the murderers, unless I can find a man of my own stature, my own quality. I have never found such a man. I have never found a man as generous as myself, as forgiving, as tolerant, as carefree, as reckless, as clean at heart. I forgive myself for every crime I have committed. I do it in the name of humanity. I know what it means to be human, the weakness and the strength of it. I suffer from this knowledge, and I revel in it also. If I had the chance to be God, I would reject it. If I had the chance to be a star, I would reject it. The most wonderful opportunity which life offers is to be human. It embraces the whole universe. It includes the knowledge of death, which not even God enjoys. At the point from which this book is written, I am the man who baptized himself anew. It is many years since this happened, and so much has come in between, that it is difficult to get back to that moment and retrace the journey of Gottlieb Leberecht Müller. However, perhaps I can give the clue if I say that the man which I now am was born out of a wound. That wound went to the heart. By all man-made logic, I should have been dead. I was, in fact, given up for dead by all who once knew me. I walked about like a ghost in their midst. They used the past tense in referring to me. They pitied me. They shoveled me under, deeper and deeper. Yet I remember how I used to laugh then, as always, how I made love to other women, how I enjoyed my food and drink, and the soft bed which I clung to like a fiend. Something had killed me, and yet I was alive. But I was alive without a memory, without a name. I was cut off from hope, as well as from remorse or regret. I had no past, and I would probably have no future. I was buried alive in a void which was the wound that had been dealt me. I was the wound itself. I have a friend who talks to me from time to time about the miracle of Golgotha, of which I understand nothing. But I do know something about the miraculous wound which I received, the wound which killed me in the eyes of the world, and out of which I was born anew and rebaptized. I know something of the miracle of this wound which I lived and which healed with my death. I tell it as of something long past, but it is with me always. Everything is long past and seemingly invisible, like a constellation which has sunk forever beneath the horizon. What fascinates me is that anything so dead and buried as I was could be resuscitated, and not just once, but innumerable times. And not only that, but each time I faded out, I plunged deeper than ever into the void, so that with each resuscitation, the miracle becomes greater. And never any stigmata. The man who is reborn is always the same man, more and more himself, with each rebirth. He is only shedding his skin each time, and with his skin, his sins. The man whom God loves is truly a right living man. The man whom God loves is the onion with a million skins. To shed the first layer is painful beyond words, the next layer is less painful, the next still less, until finally the pain becomes pleasurable, more and more pleasurable, a delight, an ecstasy. And then there is neither pleasure nor pain, but simply darkness yielding before the light. And as the darkness falls away, the wound comes out of its hiding place. The wound which is man, man's love, is bathed in light. The identity which was lost is recovered. Man walks forth from his open wound, from the grave which he had carried about with him so long. In the tomb which is my memory, I see her buried now, the one I loved better than all else, better than the world, better than God, better than my own flesh and blood. I see her festering there in that bloody wound of love, so close to me that I could not distinguish her from the wound itself. I see her struggling to free herself, to make herself clean of love's pain, and with each struggle sinking back again into the wound, mired, suffocated, writhing in blood. I see the terrible look in her eyes, the mute, piteous agony, the look of the beast that is trapped. I see her opening her legs for deliverance, and each orgasm a groan of anguish. I hear the walls falling, the walls caving in on us, and the house going up in flames. I hear them calling us from the street, the summons to work, the summons to arms, but we are nailed to the floor, and the rats are biting into us. The grave and womb of love entombing us, the night filling our bowels, and the stars shimmering over the black, bottomless lake. I lose the memory of words, of her name even, which I pronounce like a monomaniac. I forgot what she looked like, what she felt like, what she smelt like, what she fucked like, piercing deeper and deeper into the night of the fathomless cavern. I followed her to the deepest hole of her being, to the charnel house of her soul, to the breath which had not yet expired from her lips. I sought relentlessly for her whose name was not written anywhere. I penetrated to the very altar and found nothing. I wrapped myself around this hollow shell of nothingness like a serpent with fiery coils. I lay still for 6 centuries without breathing, as world events sieved through to the bottom, forming a slimy bed of mucus. I saw the constellations wheeling about the huge hole in the ceiling of the universe. I saw the outer planets and the black star which was to deliver me. I saw the dragon shaking itself free of dharma and karma, saw the new race of man stewing in the yoke of futurity. I saw through to the last sign and symbol, but I could not read her face. I could see only the eyes shining through, huge, fleshy-like, luminous breasts, as though I were swimming behind them in the electric effluvia of her incandescent vision. How had she come to expand thus, beyond all grip of consciousness? By what monstrous law had she spread herself thus over the face of the world, revealing everything and yet concealing herself? She was hidden in the face of the sun, like the moon in eclipse. She was a mirror which had lost its quicksilver, the mirror which yields both the image and the horror. Looking into the backs of her eyes, into the pulpy, translucent flesh, I saw the brain structure of all formations, all relations, all evanescence. I saw the brain within the brain, the endless machine endlessly turning, the word hope revolving on a spit, roasting, dripping with fat, revolving ceaselessly in the cavity of the third eye. I heard her dreams mumbled in lost tongues, the stifled screams reverberating in minute crevices, the gasps, the groans, the pleasurable sighs, the swish of lashing whips. I heard her call my own name, which I had not yet uttered. I heard her curse and shriek with rage. I heard everything magnified a thousand times, like a homunculus imprisoned in the belly of an organ. I caught the muffled breathing of the world, as if fixed in the very crossroads of sound. Thus we walked and slept and ate together, the Siamese twins whom love had joined and whom death alone could separate. We walked upside down, hand in hand, at the neck of the bottle. She dressed in black almost exclusively, except for patches of purple now and then. She wore no underclothes, just a simple sheath of black velvet saturated with a diabolical perfume. We went to bed at dawn and got up just as it was darkling. We lived in black holes with drawn curtains. We ate from black plates. We read from black books. We looked out of the black hole of our life into the black hole of the world. The sun was permanently blacked out, as though to aid us in our continuous internecine strife. For sun we had Mars, for moon Saturn. We lived permanently in the zenith of the underworld. The earth had ceased to revolve, and through the hole in the sky above us there hung the black star which never twinkled. Now and then we had fits of laughter, crazy batrachian laughter which made the neighbors shudder. Now and then we sang, delirious, off-key, full tremolo. We were locked in throughout the long dark night of the soul, a period of incommensurable time which began and ended in the manner of an eclipse. We revolved about our own egos, like phantom satellites. We were drunk with our own image, which we saw when we looked into each other's eyes. How then did we look to others? As the beast looks to the plant, as the stars look to the beast, or as God would look to man, if the devil had given him wings. And with it all, in the fixed, close intimacy of a night without end, she was radiant, jubilant, an ultra-black jubilation streaming from her like a steady flow of sperm from the Mithraic bull. She was double-barreled, like a shotgun, a female bull with an acetylene torch in her womb. In heat, she focused on the grand cosmocrator, her eyes rolled back to the whites, her lips a slaver. In the blind hole of sex, she waltzed like a trained mouse, her jaws unhinged like a snake's, her skin horripilating in barbed plumes. She had the insatiable lust of a unicorn, the itch that laid the Egyptians low. Even the hole in the sky through which the lackluster star shone down was swallowed up in her fury. We lived glued to the ceiling. The hot, rancid fumes of the everyday life steaming up and suffocating us. We lived at marble heat, the ascending glow of human flesh warming the snake-like coils in which we were locked. We lived riveted to the nethermost depths, our skins smoked to the color of a gray cigar by the fumes of worldly passion. Like two heads carried on the pikes of our executioners, we circled slowly and fixedly over the heads and shoulders of the world below. What was life on the solid earth to us who were decapitated and forever joined at the genitals? We were the twin snakes of paradise, lucid in heat and cool as chaos itself. Life was a perpetual black fuck about a fixed pole of insomnia, Life was Scorpio conjunction Mars, conjunction Mercury, conjunction Venus, conjunction Saturn, conjunction Pluto, conjunction Uranus, conjunction Quicksilver, Laudanum, Radium, Bismuth. The grand conjunction was every Saturday night, Leo fornicating with Draco in the house of brother and sister. The great malheur was a ray of sunlight stealing through the curtains. The great curse was Jupiter, king of the fishes, that he might flash a benevolent eye. The reason why it is difficult to tell it is because I remember too much. I remember everything, but like a dummy sitting on the lap of a ventriloquist. It seems to me that throughout the long, uninterrupted connubial solstice I sat on her lap, even when she was standing, and spoke the lines she had taught me. It seems to me that she must have commanded God's chief plumber to keep the black star shining through the hole in the ceiling, must have bid him to rain down perpetual night, and with it all the crawling torments that move noiselessly about in the dark, so that the mind becomes a twirling all, burrowing frantically into black nothingness. Did I only imagine that she talked incessantly? Or had I become such a marvelously trained dummy that I intercepted the thought before it reached the lips? The lips were finally parted, smoothed down with a thick paste of dark blood. I watched them open and close with the utmost fascination, whether they hissed a viper's hate or cooed like a turtle dove. They were always close up, as in the movie stills, so that I knew every crevice, every pore, and when the hysterical slavering began, I watched the spittle fume and foam as though I were sitting in a rocking chair under Niagara Falls. I learned what to do just as though I were a part of her organism. I was better than a ventriloquist's dummy, because I could act without being violently jerked by strings. Now and then I did things impromptu-like, which sometimes pleased her enormously. She would pretend, of course, not to notice these eruptions, but I could always tell when she was pleased by the way she preened herself. She had the gift for transformation. Almost as quick and subtle, she was as the devil himself. Next to the panther and the jaguar, she did the bird stuff best, the wild heron, the ibis, the flamingo, the swan in rut. She had a way of swooping suddenly, as if she had spotted a ripe carcass, diving right into the bowels, pouncing immediately on the tidbits, the heart, the liver, or the ovaries, and making off again in the twinkling of an eye. Did someone spot her, she would lie stone quiet at the base of a tree, her eyes not quite closed, but immovable, in that fixed stare of the basilisk. Prod her a bit, and she would become a rose, a deep black rose with the most velvety petals and of a fragrance that was overpowering. It was amazing how marvelously I learned to take my cue. No matter how swift the metamorphosis, I was always there, in her lap, bird lap, beast lap, snake lap, rose lap, what matter? The lap of laps, the lip of lips, tip to tip, feather to feather, the yolk in the egg, the pearl in the oyster, a cancer clutch, a tincture of sperm and cantharides. Life was Scorpio conjunction Mars, conjunction Venus, Saturn, Uranus, etc. Love was conjunctivitis of the mandibles, clutch this, clutch that, clutch, clutch, the mandibular clutch-clutch of the mandala wheel of lust. Come food time, I could already hear her peeling the eggs, and inside the egg, cheep, cheep, blessed omen of the next meal to come. I ate like a monomaniac, the prolonged, dreamlit voracity of the man who is thrice breaking his fast, and as I ate, she purred, the rhythmic predatory wheeze of the succubus devouring her young. What a blissful night of love! Saliva, sperm, succubation, sphincteritis, all in one. The conjugal orgy in the black hole of Calcutta. Out there where the black star hung, a pan-Islamic silence, as in the cavern world where even the wind is stilled. Out there did I dare to brood on it, the spectral quietude of insanity, the world of men lulled, exhausted by centuries of incessant slaughter. Out there, one gory, encompassing membrane within which all activity took place, the hero world of lunatics and maniacs who had quenched the light of the heavens with blood. How peaceful our little dove and vulture life in the dark! flesh to bury in with teeth or penis, abundant, odorous flesh with no mark of knife or scissors, no scar of exploded shrapnel, no mustard burns, no scalded lungs. Save for the hallucinating hole in the ceiling, an almost perfect womb life. But the hole was there, like a fissure in the bladder, and no wadding could plug it permanently, no urination could pass off with a smile. Piss large and freely, aye, but how forget the rent in the belfry, the silence unnatural, the imminence, the terror, the doom of the other world? Eat a bellyful, aye, and tomorrow another bellyful, and tomorrow, and tomorrow, and tomorrow, but finally, what then? Finally. What was finally? A change of ventriloquist, a change of lap, a shift in the axis, another rift in the vault. What? What? I'll tell you, sitting in her lap, petrified by the still, pronged beams of the black star, horned, snaffled, hitched, and trepanned by the telepathic acuity of our interacting agitation, I thought of nothing at all. Nothing that was outside the cell we inhabited, not even the thought of a crumb on a white tablecloth. I thought purely within the walls of our amoebic life, the pure thought such as Immanuel Pussyfoot Kant gave us, and which only a ventriloquist's dummy could reproduce. I thought out every theory of science, every theory of art, every grain of truth in every cockeyed system of salvation. I calculated everything out to a pinpoint, with Gnostic decimals to boot, like primes which a drunk hands out at the finish of a 6-day race. But everything was calculated for another life which somebody else would live some day, perhaps. We were at the very neck of the bottle, her and I, as they say, but the neck of the bottle had been broken off, and the bottle was only a fiction. I remember how the second time I met her, she told me that she had never expected to see me again. And the next time I saw her, she said she thought I was a dope fiend, and the next time she called me a god. And after that she tried to commit suicide, and then I tried, and then she tried again, and nothing worked except to bring us closer together, so close indeed that we interpenetrated, exchanged personalities, name, identity, religion, father, mother, brother. Even her body went through a radical change, not once, but several times. At first she was big and velvety, like the jaguar, with that silky, deceptive strength of the feline species, the crouch, the spring, the pounce. Then she grew emaciated, fragile, delicate, almost like a cornflower, and with each change thereafter she went through the subtlest modulations of skin, muscle, color, posture, odor, gait, gesture, etc. She changed like a chameleon. Nobody could say what she really was like, because with each one she was an entirely different person. After a time she didn't even know herself what she was like. She had begun this process of metamorphosis before I met her, as I later discovered. Like so many women who think themselves ugly, she had willed to make herself beautiful, dazzlingly beautiful. To do this, she first of all renounced her name, then her family, her friends, everything which might attach her to the past. With all her wits and faculties, she devoted herself to the cultivation of her beauty, of her charm, which she already possessed to a high degree, but which she had been made to believe were non-existent. She lived constantly before the mirror, studying every movement, every gesture, every slightest grimace. She changed her whole manner of speech, her diction, her intonation, her accent, her phraseology. She conducted herself so skillfully that it was impossible even to broach the subject of origins. She was constantly on her guard, even in her sleep. And, like a good general, she discovered quickly enough that the best defense is attack. She never left a single position unoccupied. Her outposts, her scouts, her sentinels were stationed everywhere. Her mind was a revolving searchlight, which was never dimmed. Blind to her own beauty, her own charm, her own personality, to say nothing of her identity, she launched her full powers toward the fabrication of a mythical creature, a Helen, a Juno, whose charms neither man nor woman would be able to resist. Automatically, without the slightest knowledge of legend, she began to create, little by little, the ontological background, the mythic sequence of events preceding the conscious birth. She had no need to remember her lies, her fictions. She had only to bear in mind her role. There was no lie too monstrous for her to utter, for in her adopted role she was absolutely faithful to herself. She did not have to invent a past. She remembered the past which belonged to her. She was never outflanked by a direct question, since she never presented herself to an adversary except obliquely. She presented only the angles of the ever-turning facets, the blinding prisms of light which she kept constantly revolving. She was never a being, such as might finally be caught in repose, but the mechanism itself, relentlessly operating the myriad mirrors which would reflect the myth she had created. She had no poise whatsoever. She was eternally poised above her multiple identities in the vacuum of the self. She had not intended to make herself a legendary figure. She had merely wanted her beauty to be recognized. But in the pursuit of beauty, she soon forgot her quest entirely, became the victim of her own creation. She became so stunningly beautiful that at times she was frightening, at times positively uglier than the ugliest woman in the world. She could inspire horror and dread, especially when her charm was at its height. It was as though the will, blind and uncontrollable, shone through the creation, exposing the monster which it is. In the dark, locked away in the black hole with no world looking on, no adversary, no rivals, the blinding dynamism of the will slowed down a bit, gave her a molten, copperish glow, the words coming out of her mouth like lava, her flesh clutching ravenously for a hold, a perch on something solid and substantial, something in which to reintegrate and repose for a few moments. It was like a frantic, long-distance message, an SOS from a sinking ship. At first I mistook it for passion, for the ecstasy produced by flesh rubbing against flesh. I thought I had found a living volcano, a female Vesuvius. I never thought of a human ship going down in an ocean of despair, in a Sargasso of impotence. Now I think of that black star gleaming through the hole in the ceiling, that fixed star which hung above our conjugal cell, more fixed, more remote than the absolute, and I know it was her, emptied of all that was properly herself, a dead black sun without aspect. I know that we were conjugating the verb love like two maniacs trying to fuck through an iron grate. I said that in the frantic grappling in the dark, I sometimes forgot her name, what she looked like, who she was. It's true. I overreached myself in the dark. I slid off the flesh rails into the endless space of sex, into the channel orbits established by this one and that one. Georgiana, for instance, of only a brief afternoon. Thelma. The Egyptian whore, Carlotta, Alana, Una, Mona, Magda, girls of six or seven, waifs, will-o'-the-wisps, faces, bodies, thighs, a subway brush, a dream, a memory, a desire, a longing. I could start with Georgiana of a Sunday afternoon near the railroad tracks, her dotted Swiss dress, her swaying haunch, her southern drawl, her lascivious mouth, her molten breasts. I could start with Georgiana, the myriad-branched candelabra of sex, and work outwards and upwards through the ramification of cunt into the nth dimension of sex, world without end. Georgiana was like the membrane of the tiny little ear of an unfinished monster called sex. She was transparently alive and breathing in the light of the memory of a brief afternoon on the avenue, the first tangible odor and substance of the world of fuck, which is in itself a being limitless and undefinable, like our world, the world. The whole world of fuck, like unto the ever-increasing membrane of the animal we call sex, which is like another being, growing into our own being and gradually displacing it, so that in time the human world will be only a dim memory of this new, all-inclusive, all-procreative being which is giving birth to itself. It was precisely this snake-like copulation in the dark, this double-jointed, double-barreled hookup which put me in the straitjacket of doubt, jealousy, fear, loneliness. If I began my hem-stitching with Georgiana and the myriad-branched candelabra of sex, I was certain that she, too, was at work building membrane, making ears, eyes, toes, scalp, and whatnot of sex. She would begin with the monster who had raped her, assuming there was truth in the story. In any case, she, too, began somewhere on a parallel track, working upwards and outwards, through this multiform, uncreated being through whose body we were both striving desperately to meet. Knowing only a fraction of her life, possessing only a bag of lies, of inventions, of imaginings, of obsessions and delusions, putting together tag ends, coke dreams, reveries, unfinished sentences, jumbled dream talk, hysterical ravings, ill-disguised fantasies, morbid desires, meeting now and then a name become flesh, overhearing stray bits of conversation, observing smuggled glances, half-arrested gestures, I could well credit her with a pantheon of her own private fucking gods, of only two vivid flesh and blood creatures, men of perhaps that very afternoon, of perhaps only an hour ago, her cunt, perhaps still choked with the sperm of the last fuck. The more submissive she was, the more passionately she behaved, the more abandoned she looked, the more uncertain I became. There was no beginning. No personal, individual starting point. We met like experienced swordsmen on the field of honor, now crowded with the ghosts of victory and defeat. We were alert and responsive to the least thrust, as only the practiced can be. We came together under cover of dark with our armies, and from opposite sides we forced the gates of the citadel. There was no resisting our bloody work. We asked for no quarter, and we gave none. We came together swimming in blood, a gory, glaucous reunion in the night, with all the stars extinguished, save the fixed black star, hanging like a scalp above the hole in the ceiling. If she were properly coked, she would vomit it forth like an oracle, everything that had happened to her during the day, yesterday, the day before, the year before last, everything, down to the day she was born. And not a word of it was true, not a single detail. Not a moment did she stop, for if she had, the vacuum she created in her flight would have brought about an explosion fit to sunder the world. She was the world's lying machine in microcosm, geared to the same unending, devastating fear which enables men to throw all their energies into creation of the death apparatus. To look at her, one would think her fearless, one would think her the personification of courage, and she was. So long as she was not obliged to turn in her traces. Behind her lay the calm fact of reality, a colossus which dogged her every step. Every day this colossal reality took on new proportions, every day it became more terrifying, more paralyzing. Every day she had to grow swifter wings, sharper jaws, more piercing, hypnotic eyes. It was a race to the outermost limits of the world, a race lost from the start, and no one to stop it. At the edge of the vacuum stood Truth, ready in one lightning-like sweep to recover the stolen ground. It was so simple and obvious that it drove her frantic. Marshal 1,000 personalities, commandeer the biggest guns, deceive the greatest minds, make the longest detour, still the end would be defeat. In the final meeting, everything was destined to fall apart. The cunning, the skill, the power, everything. She would be a grain of sand on the shore of the biggest ocean, and worse than anything, she would resemble each and every other grain of sand on that ocean shore. She would be condemned to recognize her unique self everywhere until the end of time. What a fate she had chosen for herself, that her uniqueness should be engulfed in the universal. That her power should be reduced to the utmost node of passivity. It was maddening, hallucinating. It could not be. It must not be. Onward, like the Black Legions, onward, through every degree of the ever-widening circle, onward and away from the self, until the last substantial particle of the soul be stretched to infinity. In her panic-stricken flight, she seemed to bear the whole world in her womb. We were being driven out of the confines of the universe toward a nebula which no instrument could visualize. we were being rushed to a pause so still, so prolonged, that death by comparison seems a mad witch's revel. In the morning, gazing at the bloodless crater of her face, not a line in it, not a wrinkle, not a single blemish, the look of an angel in the arms of the Creator. Who killed Cock Robin? Who massacred the Iroquois? Not I, my lovely angel could say. And by God, who, gazing at that pure, blameless face, could deny her? Who could see in that sleep of innocence that one half of the face belonged to God and the other half to Satan? The mask was smooth as death, cool, lovely to the touch, waxen, like a petal open to the faintest breeze. So alluringly still and guileless was it that one could drown in it, one could go down into it, body and all, like a diver, and never more return. Until the eyes opened upon the world, she would lie like that, thoroughly extinguished and gleaming with a reflected light, like the moon itself. In her death-like trance of innocence, she fascinated even more. Her crimes dissolved, exuded through the pores, she lay coiled like a sleeping serpent, riveted to the earth. The body, strong, lithe, muscular, seemed possessed of a weight unnatural. She had a more than human gravity, the gravity, one might almost say, of a warm corpse. She was like one might imagine the beautiful Nefertiti to have been after the first 1,000 years of mummification, a marvel of mortuary perfection, a dream of flesh preserved from mortal decay. She lay coiled at the base of a hollow pyramid, enshrined in the vacuum of her own creation, like a sacred relic of the past. Even her breathing seemed stopped, so profound was her slumber. She had dropped below the human sphere, below the animal sphere, below the vegetative sphere even. She had sunk down to the level of the mineral world, where animation is just a notch above death. She had so mastered the art of deception that even the dream was powerless to betray her. She had learned how not to dream. When she coiled up in sleep, she automatically switched off the current. If one could have caught her thus and opened up the skull, one would have found it absolutely void. She kept no disturbing secrets. Everything was killed off which could be humanly killed. She might live on endlessly, like the moon, like any dead planet, radiating an hypnotic effulgence, creating tides of passion, engulfing the world in madness, discoloring all earthly substances with her magnetic, metallic rays. Sowing her own death, she brought everyone about her to fever pitch. In the heinous stillness of her sleep, she renewed her own magnetic death by union with the cold magma of the lifeless planetary worlds. She was magically intact. Her gaze fell upon one with a transpiercing fixity. It was the moon gaze through which the dead dragon of life gave off a cold fire. The one eye was a warm brown, the color of an autumn leaf, the other was hazel, the magnetic eye which flickered like a compass needle. Even in sleep, this eye continued to flicker under the shutter of the lid. It was the only apparent sign of life in her. The moment she opened her eyes, she was wide awake. She awoke with a violent start, as if the sight of the world and its human paraphernalia were a shock. Instantly she was in full activity, lashing about like a great python. What annoyed her was the light. She awoke cursing the sun, cursing the glare of reality. The room had to be darkened, the candles lit, the windows tightly shut, to prevent the noise of the street from penetrating the room. She moved about naked, with a cigarette dangling from the corner of her mouth. Her toilet was an affair of great preoccupation. 1,000 trifling details had to be attended to before she could so much as don a bathrobe. She was like an athlete, preparing for the great event of the day. From the roots of her hair, which she studied with keen attention, to the shape and length of her toenails, every part of her anatomy was thoroughly inspected before sitting down to breakfast. Like an athlete, I said she was, but in fact she was more like a mechanic, overhauling a fast plane for a test flight. Once she slipped on her dress, she was launched for the day, for the flight which might end perhaps in Irkutsk or Tehran. She would take on enough fuel at breakfast to last the entire trip. The breakfast was a prolonged affair. It was the one ceremony of the day over which she dawdled and lingered. It was exasperatingly prolonged indeed. One wondered if she would ever take off. One wondered if she had forgotten the grand mission which she had sworn to accomplish each day. Perhaps she was dreaming of her itinerary, or perhaps she was not dreaming at all, but simply allowing time for the functional processes of her marvelous machine, so that once embarked there would be no turning back. She was very calm and self-possessed at this hour of the day. She was like a great bird of the air, perched on a mountain crag, dreamily surveying the terrain below. It was not from the breakfast table that she would suddenly swoop and dive to pounce upon her prey. No. From the early morning perch, she would take off slowly and majestically, synchronizing her every movement with the pulse of the motor. All space lay before her, her direction dictated only by caprice. She was almost the image of freedom, were it not for the Saturnian weight of her body and the abnormal span of her wings. However poised she seemed, especially at the takeoff, one sensed the terror which motivated the daily flight. She was at once obedient to her destiny and at the same time frantically eager to overcome it. Each morning she soared aloft from her perch, as from some Himalayan peak. She seemed always to direct her flight toward some uncharted region, into which, if all went well, she would disappear forever. Each morning she seemed to carry aloft with her this desperate, last-minute hope. She took leave with calm, grave dignity, like one about to go down into the grave. Never once did she circle about the flying field. Never once did she cast a glance backward toward those whom she was abandoning. Nor did she leave the slightest crumb of personality behind her. She took to the air with all her belongings, with every slightest scrap of evidence which might testify to the fact of her existence. She didn't even leave the breath of a sigh behind, not even a toenail. A clean exit, such as the devil himself might make, for reasons of his own.